Just out of curiosity, generally speaking, which CDK inhibitor and which hormone therapy, Sarah?
So, in terms of the CDK4/6 inhibitor, we have three different agents we could choose from. There's palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib. I generally think of palbociclib and ribociclib being fairly similar because they're dosed 3 weeks on, 1 week off. They both have about a 60% rate of grade 3/4 neutropenia. And so I think from a toxicity standpoint, they're fairly similar. I think the one differentiating fact is for ribociclib, it does prolong your QTc. So it does require EKG monitoring, whereas the other two drugs do not. And ribociclib is associated with a slightly higher rate of LFT elevation. And then there's abemaciclib, which is dosed very differently. It's dosed twice a day and it's dosed continuously, so there is no week off with that agent. That drug causes a little less in the way of neutropenia, so usually about a 15-20% rate of grade 3/4 neutropenia, but instead does carry with it the risk of diarrhea. So, about 15-20% of patients will develop grade 3 diarrhea with that agent. So, I think the toxicity profiles are different and the scheduling of the drugs is different. In terms of seeing a patient and saying, okay, well, which drug do I go to? We don't have any data comparing the three drugs. And if you look at the hazard ratios across all the first-line trials for all three of the agents, they actually look pretty much the same. So it's very hard to say which one is better than the other. And I don't think we can answer that. So I think physicians really need to choose a drug that they're comfortable administering and know how to manage the toxicities. To me, that's the most important thing, is that you have to know, how often do you need to see the patient to manage counts? When do you hold the drug? How do you dose reduce it? And for the abema, how do you manage the diarrhea? I think you need to become familiar with toxicity management and pick a drug that you feel comfortable with.
So I'd actually like you to actually go through each one of the three drugs and get into some of the specifics in terms of how you actually utilize them. But can you just also maybe chat a little bit about the background for the development of these drugs? What was the thinking about why they would be effective and how that kind of played out in clinical trials?
So, I think the main reason originally that these drugs became of such interest is we know that many metastatic ER-positive tumors are driven by cyclin D. And so the thought would be is that if you can inhibit that pathway, you could cause cell cycle arrest and put the cell into senescence. And potentially, eventually, that senescent state could lead to apoptosis of those cells. And then we had preclinical data suggesting that the drugs worked even better with endocrine therapy. And so initially, when these drugs were developed, each of them had phase one trials where they just looked at the drugs by themselves. And then they got into adding endocrine therapy and saw that, activity is actually much greater in combination with endocrine therapy than the drugs alone. And so they really moved forward into development as a combination. In terms of how we actually manage these drugs and how often you see patients, for all three drugs, actually, it's required that you in the guidelines, that you're supposed to see the patient every 2 weeks for the first 2 months. At those visits, you're supposed to check a CBC, particularly for ribociclib and palbociclib. They do have higher rates of neutropenia. It is also in the guidance for abemaciclib, although I have to say rates of neutropenia with that drug are so low that, it may not be completely necessary, but again, in the guidelines. And then you do also have to check liver function enzymes the first 2 weeks for the first 2 months. Thereafter, we go to monthly monitoring. And I will say, after a patient's been on the drug for a few months, if there's someone you would see less often, they've not had any dose modifications, eventually we start spacing out visits. If someone's been on it 4 to 6 months and they would come to see you every 2 months, then you can monitor their labs as needed at that point in time. So in terms of what you do if someone comes in, let's say they're cycle two, day one, and they come in with a neutrophil count of, 600 or 700, I do hold the drug at that point in time and ask them to come back in a week later and see if their neutrophil count has recovered to over 1,000. And then I usually do dose reduce. So for palbo, you go from 125 to 100. For ribociclib, you go from 600 to 400. And for abemaciclib, you go from 150 to 100 milligrams. I will say the tablets are a little different. The palbociclib, you have to write a new prescription because you have to write a new 100 milligram tablet prescription. For ribociclib, you can just take out one pill because it comes in 200 milligram tablets. For abemaciclib, it can come as 50 milligram tablets, or it can come as 150 milligram tablet. It depends how you write the script and how your insurance approves the script. But if you gave them a 150 milligram tablet, then you'll have to rewrite your prescription when you need to dose reduce.
So I'm kind of curious. We actually had a case, interesting enough, the patient was a nurse who took Palbo and did not come back for white counts at all, was a non-compliant or non-adherent, and ended up in the ICU with sepsis. This is the first case I ever heard of that happening. Has neutropenic sepsis been reported with these agents?
It's very rare. So the rate of febrile neutropenia across the trials has been, you know, in the 2% or less range, so between 1% to 2%. So it's very unusual to develop febrile neutropenia. So that's a horrible case.
You know, with all the caveats about indirect comparisons, your colleague Hal Burstein actually at a meeting we had recently put up a slide with all three agents, hazard rates all together. And he said, I know I'm not supposed to do it, but they all look the same. Can you talk a little bit about actually what the trials have shown in terms of the magnitude, the hazard ratios, the impact on both progression-free and overall survival with these agents?
So generally, the hazard ratio in the first-line setting has been around 0.55. So, you know, you're really almost doubling progression-free survival across all three drugs in the first-line setting. So it's really pretty profound going from a 10 to 12-month PFS to, you know, 22, 24, now even 26 months. And so it's pretty impressive in the amount and degree of benefit we're seeing. We have not yet seen an overall survival benefit. To date, I think the data is a little immature, and I think we need to wait longer to see if we're going to see that. And I think it's going to be challenging. You know, these patients have so many different options after progression. And, you know, honestly, it's hard to know if we'll see that survival benefit.